special Friday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast after the Warriors defeat the Cavaliers in Game 4 to go up 3-1 in the series, likely an insurmountable lead now. Danny, you were there. What were your initial thoughts after this one?
It was a really weird first half just because the Cavs, you know, they were getting all these offensive rebounds, and I thought they were playing pretty good defense, but it felt unsustainable to me, and I won't say that the way that the Warriors came back was particularly sustainable either, but it did feel not inevitable, but like the most likely outcome when given how aberrational that first half was.
So what did you, other than the offensive rebounds, was there anything about it? Because, I mean, I think usually when it's the home team that's playing really well and the crowd is really into it. I mean, I meant to ask you this later, but I'll just ask you now, that, like, was that really kind of like the mood that you had, that you felt like everyone had there, or were the fans sort of like, yeah, we are, fate is on our side, this is inevitable, like, we're up five, we're playing great?
No, the fans were very optimistic. I mean, the only time when they lost it was when the Warriors got all the way back and tied the game, and then they're like, oh, crap, because that was right with a Klay and Steph run. But before that, they were pretty defiant. I mean, and the Cavs were playing well. They were getting a ton of offensive rebounds. But what I was noticing, and I think you noticed this too, was that the Cavs' first shots were not only missing, but they weren't missing very well. And generally when that happens, when I'm watching, why I thought it was an aberration is that I think that's something that can persist. That, you know, that means the defense is doing something right. And I also thought that Andre and Draymond did a lot better in the second half than they did in the first, and I thought they did a pretty good job in the first.
Yeah, I thought that the defense was good, especially once they went with Green at center. I said that Kerr should not overreact to the offensive rebounds, especially because a lot of them were just kind of plays that were like air balls, weird misses, like we talked about, and were just, you know, and a couple of them were just McAdoo, like, not being able to get his hands up quickly enough as they, like, I mean, I think it's pretty hard to, like, almost get hit in the head by an offensive rebound and not get it, but he almost did that a couple of times. And, you know, it was just, and also the Warriors were always going to have the energy advantage down the end of the game, just with the way that Kerr does his substitutions, as opposed to the way that Lou does. That's the next thing that I wanted to focus on, is I just thought, outside of the Warriors shooting, which of course was unbelievable in this game, but also most of their looks were wide open. You know, this wasn't like the type of looks that Klay Thompson was hitting against Oklahoma City in Game 6. These were like pretty good open looks for the most part for the Warriors. But I feel like the Cavs ran out of gas down the end. Do you agree with that?
I do. And there are a lot of different ways you can talk about it, and Lou was asked about it, and his comments were disturbing. But when I was looking at it, the guy that I noticed it most with was Kyrie Irving. And he's shouldering a gigantic load in this series because he has Curry a fair amount of the time, and they're asking him to do a lot offensively. He's averaging 38 minutes a game in this series, despite there being two absolute dead-bang blowouts in this series. And that's bad. You know, no overtime games, to average 38 minutes a game. We played, I think, 43 tonight. You know, that's too much for a guy to handle, especially when he has a capable substitute.
Well, here, you mentioned Lou's quote on the minutes. He was asked about the fatigue factor. I thought it was quite palpable, as the Warriors got basically every loose ball in the second half, and he did not think that fatigue was a factor, and here's what he had to say on that score.
Coach Dan Devine, Yahoo Sports. Early in the fourth quarter, you have a real rough patch. It was the Warriors going on a 12-1 run. What were you seeing from your team during that stretch? They missed six straight shots, a couple turnovers. And as a follow-up to that, the fatigue, how much did that play a factor in the fourth quarter? You had major minutes for LeBron and for Kyrie and for JR.
It could have played a part in it, but, you know, going into the fourth quarter, you know, being down 2-1, we're down 2 points. They brought their bench in, so I thought if we can keep our starters in for a few minutes, you know, we can kind of make a run and then get guys out slowly. But they were able to go on the run, so, you know, it hurt us. But, you know, I went with my best players, you know, in the fourth quarter, down 2-1, and, you know, it didn't work.
Ramona on the left.
Hi, Ramona Shelburne, ESPN. LeBron played 45 minutes. Have you guys discussed how many minutes he's playing and how many he thinks he can play effectively?
No.
Do you think it's something that you need to discuss with him? Is he able to play that many minutes and still be effective at the end of the game?
Well, when it's time to win and you're the NBA Finals, you got to play as many minutes as you need to. So if you got to play 96 minutes, you got to play 96 minutes. You know, we're trying to win. We're in the finals, and he could have got tired, and it could have been fatigue, but, you know, in the NBA Finals, you got to lay it all on the line, and then 9 days, you can rest all summer.
You know, I remember that Monty Williams said something very similar about Anthony Davis in the first round last year when I asked him about the minutes. He said, hey, it's the playoffs. You just got to play however many minutes. And it's not a question of toughness. It's just a question of the human body is only capable of so much. And the idea, and even psychologically too, I mean, the idea that you can't find a minute or two for these guys, like their bench is good. They got Fry, they got Delly, Shumpert. Like, those are like three guys you should be able to get enough out of that. And Jefferson, too. I mean, they have nine guys who are capable of playing very effectively. The idea that you can't get LeBron James or Kyrie Irving any rest at all in the second half, especially when you're at home, and it's not like the game was like getting out of control either. It was just pretty remarkable to me.
Yeah, and while Kyrie's offense was really singing in the first half, and he was doing a nice job of creating easy looks and hitting tough ones, he was struggling with that in the second half. And his replacement, the guy who played in the finals last year, Matthew Dellavedova, is a natural defensive player. So, like, I mean, when Bronson is much less of a creator and more of an, I mean, he does create, but he's more off the ball than he is otherwise. So just play Dellavedova, you know, give him some minutes during that time, and he played less than 5 in this game. You can balance that a lot closer and still get plenty of value out of Kyrie, even as you've said before, just giving him like a 1 or 2 minute breather just to really get back in it, especially if you can time it with some sort of TV timeout.
The difference for the Cavaliers in the first half of this game and in all of Game 3 was their energy. They had more energy than Golden State. That really is the biggest thing for Lou that you have to monitor. And it's not only energy in the sense of, I mean, you remember the phrase, fatigue makes cowards of us all, right? Like, that's a cliche, but fatigue mentally, when your body is tired, is almost more important. And the Cavs had so many screw-ups in that second half on coverages, on three-pointers, and just not to mention the fact that they just couldn't summon the energy to get to loose balls. And the other factor, too, is that guys like Curry and Thompson, if you are not putting in Delly or you're not putting in Shumpert as much, those are the guys who now are fresh that can make those guys work and get tired themselves. So you're now giving up that advantage. Kyrie Irving and J.R. Smith are just not going to, are not the type of like get right into your jersey defenders that can just make guys get tired. And Steph, frankly, hasn't done that well with a lot of the holding in this playoff series. But when you have guys who are more tired than they are, you're not able to take advantage of that either.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it was impressive to me how basically everybody that the Cavs played in the first half did a really good job, and that didn't embolden them to keep going back to those guys. I thought Love did a nice job in the first half. I thought Jefferson was solid when he was on the court.
Although Lou did of course play Love probably like, I don't know what it was, like 16 straight minutes or something probably in the second half too, you know? So you're going to get tired that way, especially when you're coming back off of concussion. You've had some inactivity for a while.
Yeah, you're required to, right?
Yeah, so it was, I thought that was really something that the Cavs gave away, because other than the 3-point shooting, that's where they got beat, was I thought, in the effort categories. And despite that unbelievable offensive rebounding first quarter, in which they got over 50% of their misses back, by the end of the game, the Warriors had offensive rebounded a higher percentage than they had. The Warriors got during what I'll call the competitive portion of the game until the Cavs got a bunch of just quick twos and they were fouling on the other end. The Warriors got 14 offensive rebounds and the Cavs had 24 defensive rebounds. And that's actually a little bit better percentage, I think, than what the Cavs were able to get themselves. Both teams actually, I think, had over 40% offensive rebounds, or pretty close to it, in this game, which you don't see very often in this day and age. But that's actually kind of one underrated aspect of that Warriors small unit, is that if you go small to match them, they actually are probably going to be playing with more force than you are, and they can actually hurt you on the offensive glass.
Well, yeah, that was one of the stories of Game 2 when they tried LeBron at center and just got run off the floor, was that lineup. And something that I'd be interested just in talking to you about, we didn't prep this, is there was a lot of discussion both in the post-game media stuff and everything and on Twitter from what I could tell about the officiating. A lot of that seemed to be centered around LeBron. I thought the officiating in the game wasn't particularly good, but I didn't think LeBron was poorly officiated.
No, I didn't either, and that's a good way to segue into just talking about the way that he played. There's a lot of the post-game talking heads, you know, Scott Van Pelt and Brendan Haywood, like I was watching that show, and, you know, Vince Carter said, I can't fathom why, like, he's not being more aggressive. Like, he's being plenty aggressive, guys. Like, he's going to the basket. He took 10 shots in the restricted area. He made 6 of them. They were just double-teaming him. He was making the right pass, especially in the first half. Like, ABC showed a montage of him getting near the rim, but still basically having two guys in between him and the basket and saying, oh, you got to go up. Like, that's a bad shot. That's a 40% shot, a 35% shot, probably when it's that pressured. He was making the right play and passing out, and the Cavs were scoring very efficiently, in large part as well due to the offensive rebounds in the first half. But this idea that they lost because he wasn't aggressive, no. Like, when he tried to be aggressive and just go through guys, he was just getting stripped. He was missing layups. He was, wasn't able to hit his jump shot. Like, and also that takes a ton of energy, and they have a fresh defender on him all the time too. And he's not able to beat that guy. What happens, and you talked about the fouls, yeah, he got stripped a lot. But that's what happens when you're not really beating your guy. You're just sort of like, having him fall back and knocking him backwards a little bit. And then he's still in between you and the basket and there's help coming over. That's when you're going to have situations where there's a strip and you're probably not going to get the foul call in that situation, especially because it's like in close quarters, you're bringing the ball up right in front of the guy. It's hard for the referee to make that call, even if there is some contact, because it looks clean.
Yeah, I'm going to change around an expression, but never mistake a lack of achievement for a lack of effort. You know, lack of activity. He was trying out there. And one of the things that makes the Warriors different, partially because they have really intelligent, active defenders, is that I think they have a much better idea of where LeBron is going to have the ball when he drives. And they're putting their hand in the right place and knocking it out. And that is a really hard thing to counter, especially when very few teams do it. You know, you get that into, if you want to call it muscle memory, you can. And LeBron is struggling with that, and I can understand why, but he's still doing a nice job of being active and creating for other people, even though that crazy stat about, was it 33 of 38 in the second half of their shots were from LeBron and Kyrie?
Yeah, that is a lot, obviously, and that, again, was the result of the Warriors switching, making those guys go one-on-one. And, LeBron did have those 3 layups late, so that 8 out of 18 and his 6 of 10 shooting at the rim, that was really, I didn't count those last 3 buckets because they're just letting him score. And then he was 2 of 8 outside the paint. That was one of the things we talked about as another bellwether, was what was he going to shoot outside the paint? The Warriors were just backing off him. He hit 1 3 when they really backed off of him. But other than that, he, again, wasn't able to blow by guys the way that he was in game 3 because he wasn't hitting the jump shot. And another thing we should talk about, too, we mentioned the energy. We mentioned the number of minutes he played, all 24 minutes in the second half, same as Kyrie. If you are asking a guy to not only handle the ball on nearly every possession and not even shoot jumpers, like try to drive to the basket and score over guys, go through guys offensively, and then you also need him to play as a small ball power forward and really get on the glass, be a help defender, that I think is probably too much to ask for just about anybody, especially a 31-year-old with the miles that he has on him. So that's another reason why this, if you're going to make him be a small ball four, which I think he can be really good at, he just has to get more rest. Like you have to get the defense by getting more rest and win the effort categories if you're Cleveland.
And there's also a difference. Like, the Warriors did rely heavily on their top 7 guys in this game, but they still were getting them rest. They were cycling in and out, and not only that, but they were cycling in and out of assignments. Whereas LeBron, in particular, was basically, he was working at a high energy the entire game. And that's hard for anybody to sustain. And also, while this game, I believe, was lower in terms of possessions, a lot of that was just because of the crazy amount of offensive rebounds, particularly early. Like, it seemed like when they were moving up and down the floor, they were moving with some speed.
Yeah, and actually, I think that offensive rebounding, to a certain extent, allowed them to get more rest in the first half because you're just kind of staying down there on offense when there was more back and forth. I think that was more fatiguing as well. What did you think of Steph's game? Steph had 38 points, although fattened up on some intentional fouling late, but was 7 out of 13 on threes, but only 4 of 12 on twos.
He looked better than he's looked in the series, but I still don't. You don't sit there and look at the 38 points and go, oh, he's back. He didn't look back to me, but he looked better. Still a little bit tentative. Still lost on defense a lot. Like, that was
in the first half, he was really bad. And then in the second half, in part because they weren't moving the ball as much and getting as much in the way of ball movement, didn't have those long possessions with all the offensive rebounds. I thought he didn't really have many mistakes and did a much better job in isolation on Kyrie, except for that one time when Kyrie kind of broke his ankles a little bit.
Agreed.
But yeah, I mean, I think the 4-12, that's been the biggest difference probably of anything in his performance since returning from the knee injury. Like, I'd love to know what he's shooting on floaters and layups. where, you know, you're shooting like 70% at the rim and, you know, awesome percentage on floaters too. Just all those great touch shots where you're like, nobody else in the league makes it, but you kind of expect him to. Like, those just haven't gone down for him since the injury. And, you know, that could just be bad luck. It could also be, you know, the fact that he doesn't quite have the explosion necessary. But it's definitely a fact. I mean, and it's kind of too bad for me, because I fear that what Steph did this year, which was unprecedented really in NBA history, is something that we're not going to see again. Because you figure, number one, he's going to miss some of his offseason workouts due to this MCL injury. This is also like kind of the first knee injury that he's had. Probably shouldn't be anything that's permanent damage, but, you know, he's going to need to take some time off. He's not going to be able to have his usual maniacal work ethic. Then you consider just the fact that he's going to be 28, 29 next year, getting out of his prime a little bit, losing a little bit of his athleticism. The fact then that just you're going to regress to the mean. I mean, I think he probably just won't be able to get as many three-pointers off. You know, he averaged whatever it was, like 11 three-point attempts a game this year. And I think also his two-point percentage will decline. But, you know, again, I think the way he's played in these playoffs is how he's going to look, you know, as a 30, 31-year-old. I think he'll be better next year than he was in these playoffs, but I don't think he'll ever reach again the heights of this regular season, which is kind of too bad, but that's why it was an unprecedented season to begin with.
But yeah, he had one of the best offensive seasons in NBA history, and it's you never bet on somebody to repeat that, just like you won't expect the Warriors to have a 73-win record again. You know, like, that's just, it's just the nature of things, though. We were both skeptical that he would, you know, really expand off of what he did last year, and he did that. So I'm not saying he'll do that again. He won't. But I will give him a little bit of deference, but it will be fascinating to see how he handles this injury.
I also thought that we should discuss, like, what Tyronn Lue did with Kevin Love. There was some chatter on the broadcast that Love said, hey, if you need to bring me off the bench, that's fine. I thought that was the correct move. I was saying that. Did you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that gave him a better chance to succeed. I thought he looked good, especially in the first half. And Jefferson had done a nice job in the starting lineup, so I had no opposition to it.
He did get worked a couple of times by Anderson Varejão in the third quarter on the offensive glass, and another time where he just, you know, it was a flop by Varejão, but it was a pretty clear foul where he shoved him. So basically gave that sort of almost another offensive rebound. But it was, I mean, I think it was more just, you know, Love is he's kind of a shooter on this team. You know, he had like a couple of posts, like he had one, got fouled on one post up. He had a nice turnaround over Livingston that kind of rimmed in, but he's just not dynamic enough. I don't know whether it's just because of this team, or I suspect more likely that the game and his role is just kind of passed him by a little bit, but their teams are just so much better at dealing with four men who can shoot now. He's not quite dynamic enough posting up against combo forward types that you can really go to that as a regular diet and force help. And then the greater shooting on the floor, even just in these 2 years generally, since his heyday in Minnesota, especially for the best teams, makes it more difficult to have an elite defense with him out there, although I think generally he tries pretty hard. But that's so I don't know. I think now it looks like they're going to lose in five. We'll have plenty of time to talk about potential K-Love trades, but it looks like you would have to imagine he's probably going to be shipped out. But maybe they even would think about Irving if, Irving is someone you could really, really get something for. I don't know that you really can get that much for Love at this point with him having four more years left on his contract still.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. And an example for me, and I'm sure it stuck out to you, was Iguodala had an amazing closeout on him. It was in the second half. I think it was in the fourth quarter. And it was
And then Andre also rotated back to strip LeBron after Love did, I thought, a pretty decent job of, like, driving to the basket afterwards.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, it was pretty slow, right? Like, he's not going to do anything against, a wing guy, like, in that situation. It was kind of the point you're going to make, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, you think about something that you and I have talked about with a lot of different stretchy fours is what happens when you put a smaller guy on them. And Love, at this point, as much as his post success throughout the year was somewhat ballyhooed, he's not that great in that. He's great when he has a real mismatch, but when he has like a small advantage, I don't think he's great in that situation. And defensively, he's just clearly flawed. And I think that there will be a market for him, but it's not going to be this robust, you know, like you're going to sit there like the Celtics are going to give you a mint for him or anything like that. And that could theoretically, depending on how David Griffin plays it, could make him more likely to, you know, stick around at least for a little while, because teams hate selling low on guys. And so we could see that one last a little bit longer, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't know if he's going to get any higher next year, just being the third option and being 29 instead of 28. You know,
yeah.
So, but another couple of things we should talk about too. It's going to be overshadowed because this is all Steph's big comeback game. But Klay Thompson was awesome. He actually, I think, was more efficient than Steph was. He played some pretty decent defense, avoided foul trouble. And that was one of the things, is that both he and Steph were very much on the line of first quarter foul trouble again. And that was an underrated factor, I think, in the Warriors' struggles in game three. Not that they would have not lost by, but you know, maybe they wouldn't have lost by 30 had it not been for that. And those guys avoiding the foul trouble. Klay did get two, but it was kind of right around the time when he was going to go out, and then he never got his third in a compromising time. That was big. And then Barnes was fantastic on the glass, 4 of 5 on threes. So, and he played 40 minutes, which actually is probably the biggest statistic of this game. I don't think he's been anywhere near that in any of these playoff games. And I thought that Kerr just choosing to play him more rather than Barbosa, rather than, you know, Livingston, maybe not quite as much. I thought that that was good. I think that Barnes is kind of the second guy other than Festus Ezeli who they kind of get away from trusting. And I thought that he was excellent on the boards. And obviously that 3-point shooting was enormous. He hit one of the biggest threes of the game too.
Yeah. Barnes had, he never got higher than 38 minutes in the rest of it, despite playing a lot of that without Curry. So of course the rotations were out of whack and they were relying a lot more on guys like Harrison Barnes. And you and I didn't record together after game three, but I thought he was the only Warrior that had a good game, and I thought he played very well. And his defense isn't as spectacular as Iguodala or Green's, but I think that his activity and his strength helps make everything else work, because we just talked about Kevin Love and how he kind of creates seams, and Barnes just doesn't do that very often.
Yeah, he's not a weak link. You know, I mean, he switched on to Kyrie Irving and did a credible job. He switches on to Love, he can do a credible job. He can get on the glass. He fights. He's strong. He gives good effort. He's made less defensive mistakes. I mean, he's not, doesn't have like unbelievable intelligence as far as like his help defense and like knowing when to help and when to get back to shooters and stuff. But yeah, he's solid. You know, if a team tries to sign him and say, hey, you're going to be our lockdown guy on the wing, and he probably actually would be the best guy on a lot of teams, but you know, they're probably going to be a little disappointed. And of course, Draymond Green also was fantastic defensively. Once again, protecting the rim with his effort, pushing the ball in transition. He had a couple of plays, and those take a ton out of you when you dribble the ball up the court absolutely as hard and as fast as you can, trying to take it full. And he did 3 or 4 of those in this game that were big plays. He got fouled, found Klay Thompson for a 3-pointer on one of those plays. But yeah, I mean, he and Andre are just so good defensively, and they, other than in game three, they've just been massive forces defensively in this series.
Yeah, and part of being a great defender for me is the ability to kind of do other things but not lose your original assignment, and they're both just great helpers, and they can do that without sacrificing solid coverage on their guy.
So I want to go through some of my notes from the game just in chronological order here. But first, I want to tell you about Athletes Collective. I went to the gym a couple of days ago, and I set a personal record for myself in the deadlift. And I owe it all to Athletes Collective. Do you believe that, Danny?
I'm a little dubious, but comfort is very important.
Of course you don't believe it, because that would be stupid. Athletes Collective did not, and no other activewear either, is going to make me perform so much incredibly better while I'm at the gym or playing basketball or whatever I'm doing. So why are you going to pay for this myth that it somehow is going to make you perform better because some celebrities endorse it? That doesn't really make any sense. Instead, if you get Athletes Collective, you can get great quality, great fitting activewear without the logos for 30 to 40% cheaper than those big brands at athletescollective.com. And don't forget, of course, to enter that cap space code, which will get you 15% off your first order. And all orders, of course, include free shipping and returns to the US or Canada. So it's athletescollective.com. Cap space code gets you that discount. The stuff does look good on me, according to my girlfriend. It fits really well. Wicks sweat away. It's also pre-shrunk, so unlike some of the other moisture wicking stuff, if you're a single guy, you're doing laundry, you're living in the city, you go down to the laundromat, just throw it in there, dry it with everything else, don't have to hang dry it or any of that crap, which you have to do with some of the other stuff. So it's really an excellent company. The owner, Adam, is a big fan of the show. That's why I decided to start advertising. So he definitely supports our show, and hopefully you'll support him in turn. AthletesCollective.com, promo code CAPSPACE. So that first quarter was just incredibly slow, but incredibly efficient for both teams. The Warriors had 29 points on 19 possessions, and you know, an average Warriors game is usually 100. They have not been anywhere close to that, actually, since the middle of the Oklahoma City series. And then 28 on 18 possessions for Cleveland. The Warriors just were scoring really well, and Cleveland was just getting every single offensive rebound, mostly Tristan Thompson, who I think he might have had like six offensive rebounds in the first quarter, I think.
I think he had five in the first quarter. And I think it was in the first half, he had five, the rest of the Cavs had five, and the Warriors had five total. So, you know, so that tells you how big an impact he was having. And we talked about it a little bit, but I want to single out a specific play. I believe it was in the first quarter when, where Clay was running down. It was Clay and Draymond were running down after a turnover. I think it was a bad step pass. Like, he tried to go behind the back a couple times where he did that. And Draymond basically just yelled at Clay not to foul. And so Clay just basically ran away. And it was really important because it's something that I've harped on a lot. I actually get mentions on Twitter about this, is that Clay does not necessarily understand the situation. He's just on instinct with fouls. And so certain points, you just need somebody to yell at you.
Yeah, I think that was right. He actually then got out of the way and on another one, too. You're right, it was the second quarter. It was that LeBron fast break layup. Kumbaya Kerr mode went to McAdoo in the first quarter. I think the idea was that they just needed someone else at center. Well, I thought where he started off well was going to the death lineup early for at least 2-3 minutes during the middle of the first quarter. And that was one of the big problems, partially due to the foul trouble, but also partially due to not starting it. We had called for them to start it. They did not, but they at least got it in there early. And it's really those five guys together all really kind of depend on one another. And so when there was the foul trouble, when you weren't starting it, I think they only played, 6 minutes or something in game three?
Yeah, I think it was about that.
Yeah, and in this game, they were much better, and they played a lot more together. So, and I think they outscored the Cavs by 8 points in their minutes or something like that.
I'll talk about how that happened partially, is that Kerr, in an intelligent move, has changed Draymond's sub pattern because he wants him out there at the start of the second and fourth quarters, because that's when the Cavs have historically gone to that really dangerous LeBron-Fry combination. And so by doing that, he's pulling Draymond earlier, you know, often he would play the whole first and third, and then he would get his break at the beginning of the second and fourth. But when that changed around, they've already at that point gone away from their traditional centers. So the question is, who do you bring in? And it has been, let's call it an adventure to see how he's handled that over these four games.
Yeah, but McAdoo, the thought was that he at least could switch out a little bit better on the pick and roll, get out to shooters, although, again, you know, he's not really the most intelligent, but at least it would have some energy, and he got like a nice dunk in the first quarter. I think they even ran a play for him, which worked out pretty well. He had a nice switch, but also was really bad on the defensive glass against Thompson. I mean, while McAdoo has the skills of a center and really should only play center, he's like actually kind of skinny even for a power forward, and Tristan Thompson was able to beast him a little bit. But, I mean, I think the key was more, and he got away with Bergeron minutes again in the third, that he needed someone to come in there. I thought that should have been Azili more, and Azili, again, had, you know, cleaned up the defensive glass and then made a bunch of mistakes and got a defensive 3 seconds as well, which was a little bit dubious. But Kerr at least went to somebody. You know, I mean, they need, you can't just play, if you're Ty Lue, you would just play Draymond Green at center for like 48 minutes a game. You know, it's just not going to work.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I mean, Lue's attitude of like manning up, I think that helped keep Draymond more fresh, and he was huge in the second half.
Yeah, in the second quarter and then even into the start of the third, I thought that the Warriors actually really let the referees get into their heads a little bit. Now, they obviously didn't lose the game, but there were multiple plays on which guys just completely stopped during live play because they thought a foul should have been called or to complain. Green, even at the start of the third at one point, on the first play of the game, he drove. He thought he got hit in the head, and was so busy tapping himself in the head and complaining that the offensive rebound like was right in his hands, and he just didn't grab it, and someone took it away from him. It was just incredibly bad. There was another play where Steph just like kind of got elbowed on a screen on defense, and then Kyrie ran to the other side, and Steph just sort of like stopped and like looked at the ref for 3 seconds, and they weren't able to find Kyrie. He actually finally was like, oh yeah, I gotta start playing defense, and ran back to him. But it was really Andre had a couple of plays where he stopped too. It was very uncharacteristic of the Warriors to just straight up stop, but it ended up not coming back to haunt them, and they were able to play their game. And I thought a big thing too, we talked about this many times for Golden State, that the less fouls that are called, the better it is for them. Despite the fact that they're supposedly this soft team, they don't really get fouled that much on offense. And then on defense, they strip a lot. They contest at the rim a lot. And if fouls are not being called on those plays, not that I felt like there were fouls that shouldn't necessarily been called in the second half, but the less fouls, the better for Golden State, almost universally true.
Yeah, one thing that was completely dumbfounding to me, and it's fun to talk about this when I was in the arena and you weren't, just because we had different perspectives and different angles and all that kind of stuff, was I was completely flabbergasted by how the Warriors were choosing to run so many screens with Tristan Thompson, you know, with I think it was usually he was on Draymond or on the centers. And then Kevin Love, who was bad in pick-and-roll defense, who was often on Harrison Barnes, they just weren't using that at all. And that is something that the Warriors have had trouble with in the past, but they actually did a nice job towards the end of the Oklahoma City series of actually using that.
Yeah, towards the end of the second quarter, when the death lineup was out there for like the last 5 minutes and Cleveland, I think, actually outscored it, the Warriors were running a lot of pick-and-roll, which I had said I think we really wanted Steph to be doing more of. But yeah, you're right. They're just involving, like, Thompson was guarding Barnes and Love was guarding Iguodala, and they're just having Barnes set every screen. That didn't really make any sense. And Thompson was doing a pretty nice job switching out onto Curry. Again, you know, sort of evidence that Curry is still not quite himself. I mean, you remember what he did to Thompson last year in the finals on those switches, and even in the regular season this year, and Thompson has been able to stick with him much better. Credit to him, but he's you know, he can switch out onto most players to be sure, but Steph not quite the same level of explosiveness. I thought the other thing, that especially in the second quarter, Kyrie had some just unbelievable finishes, even over very good contests by Golden State. But, you know, he didn't quite have the legs for those same kind of plays in the second half, although maybe he was due to regress, because even he, great finisher that he is, like, isn't going to be able to make, you know, 100% of those type of shots, you know, falling away from the rim with a little bit of body contact contested the way he was.
And that ties in a little bit with what I thought was one of the big turning points in this game, which is that while Cleveland had done a nice job defending 1-5 pick and rolls of the Warriors early on in this game and in game three, Bogut was clearing more space for Curry in particular in the third quarter, and the Cavs just never countered it.
Yeah, it probably would be interesting to look at all of the Golden State threes in the third. I went back and watched them before we started. They gave up 6 threes in the third, the Cavs did. The first two were Curry just coming straight off of a Bogut screen. One was on JR, one was on Kyrie, and those guys didn't have the best techniques on the plays. Bogut clearly with a semi-illegal screen, although probably not a lot of room for complaining with those guys as much as Curry was getting held himself. I mean, it was just, it was a war out there in a lot of respects, and you know, those two plays, Bogut was very important setting the screen. He then also had a huge block on Tristan Thompson. He played much better at the start of the third. It looked like he was going to get torched when he gave up an offensive rebound. Kyrie hit the first shot of the half because he, you know, taking advantage of him in pick and roll defense, but he got better, forced a couple of misses, and then after a blocked shot on Thompson, they're able to push the ball down, and Kyrie just helped a little bit too much on Draymond Green, even though Richard Jefferson was right on his hip. This is one of those plays where Green just pushed it as hard as he could, and Kyrie overreacted to that. You know, you want Green shooting a tough layup going 1,000 miles an hour with Jefferson right there to contest, and instead he just let Clay get a wide open three, and Jefferson yelled at him after that when they called timeout.
Yeah, and then the next couple, they started doing something that you and I both love and that I was actually complaining about earlier in the game, was they actually ran some actions where Clay and Steph were screening for each other.
Yeah, normally you would think that's pretty easy to deal with, right? You just switch it, Kyrie and Smith, but those two guys, not the greatest communicators, and the Warriors did well. The first time around, Kyrie clearly should have switched onto Clay, because Clay actually set a pretty hard screen and then moved. JR stayed with Steph, so did Kyrie, and gave up a wide open three on just that pick and pop for Clay. And then the next time down, they ran the same play, except Clay just faked the screen and went out. Now, both guys on that one went with Clay. Steph still had the ball, and he just missed a wide open three. So you saw the communication really kind of starting, and just the off-ball defense starting to break down a little bit for the Cavaliers. And another play was, again, in transition. Barnes did a great job with Love having position on him, tapping the defensive rebound out. And then Love and Thompson had both gone for the offensive rebound. Thompson ran back, but ran back to the paint, and Steph was just wide open in the corner for off a nice pass from Klay Thompson after Andre Iguodala, again, pushed the ball hard. I mean, that's one of the things that you just, taking your first two or three dribbles really hard when you get the ball in the outlet, even if it doesn't look like there's anything there right away, just to force the defense to react to you a little bit, get it up faster, get your teammates to run with you, like that can be very important.
Yeah, whether he is a Warrior or not next year, that is something that if Harrison Barnes could do it, this Warriors team gets even harder to defend, because if they can have basically, they can trot out lineups where all five guys are comfortable, because Klay has gotten more comfortable doing that over the last year or two. And so if you can get to that point, it's just so hard because almost every team is playing somebody who either gets out of position or is a little bit slow, and you're putting so much strain, and then you start to panic kind of any time you miss a shot.
Barnes will never be able to do that.
Probably not, but he could work on it.
He's tried very hard to improve that, and I think early in the year he was trying to, and then just had a few turnovers, and now he just outlets the ball to the power forward.
I don't know if you saw it, but I laughed really hard. There was one play where Draymond, I think somebody kind of came up on him, so he passed it to Harrison Barnes. Barnes dribbled twice, almost lost the ball. Like, he came really close to lofting, and then just like sheepishly passed it back to Draymond. I was like, okay, I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah, and then the last three that they had was Andre Iguodala faking like he was going to set a down screen for Klay. Klay went away. Both Kevin Love and J.R. Smith went with Klay, even though Klay was going backdoor, and then Andre just popped out and got, not a wide open three, a reasonably open three. I mean, that's not a shot where, and there was definitely a miscommunication, but that's kind of the kind of shot you probably have to live with if you are Cleveland. The Varejao minutes looked like they were going to be a disaster at the start.
They kind of were. It worked out, though.
It was because Kerr put him in, and it was when Love was at center, so he was guarding Love, and you're like, oh man, like this is just, how's he going to get out on Love and then also help? And he did give up a layup when he wasn't able to help off of Love. He gave up a two-shot foul on Love as well. He fouled immediately after coming in the game, but he also hit two free throws when he flopped after Love fouled him, and then he had three offensive rebounds, one of which just he lucked into at the top of the key, but the other two were great plays. One was on a free throw where he just beat Love, and the other one he ran in, did his favorite, like, run in and jump off of 1 foot and got the offensive rebound. So it was, and he made a nice play, too, on a short roll, finding Iguodala for a wide open three that missed. So he actually, he earned the fact that they didn't get killed in his minutes. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's kind of outcome-based decision-making. I wouldn't want him guarding Love at center in the next game, but it wasn't like he was just so terrible.
I referred to it as the most eventful. I said it was plus zero outing, but it ended up being minus one because there was just so much going on. And, like, I mean, because he does so much defensively that's just kind of crazy. And then he, on offense, it looks like he's either trying to, like, kill himself for an offensive board or for a flop. But it worked out. And, Kurt deserves credit for it working out. I mean, I'm always a process over results guy, but when you push the buttons right, some of the times, maybe I shouldn't criticize them as much. But at the same point, there was a lot of ways that that could have gone sour real fast.
Yeah, and I think in that situation, Azeeley trying to, like, guard a shooter in the corner probably wouldn't have been much better. I mean, Green had to get some rest. I thought it was a little bit of a mistake to keep Green in as the four man. I felt like you don't want to use any of his minutes when he's not at the five with some of those big shooting lineups that Cleveland has, because it looked like the start of the fourth quarter could be a disaster. Lou, in a gambit, left LeBron in. He left Kyrie in. He left Love in. And then the Warriors had McAdoo, Livingston, Andre, Barnes, and Klay. And they survived until Draymond and Curry came back in, actually outscored the Cavs 7-6 during that period. But the Cavs actually took the lead. And then probably the biggest play of the game, LeBron had a tip dunk just all over Barnes' head. And Livingston just came down totally innocuous, wasn't really even doing anything on the left wing, throws it to Barnes, and LeBron was just standing at the free throw line, just didn't bother to guard Barnes at the three-point line, and Barnes just hit a three to put the Warriors up by one, and that they never would relinquish the lead after that time. And so really, you knew that once the Warriors survived that time, that the Cavs were in grave danger of running out of gas, and that's exactly what happened. They had scored 77 points on 62 possessions through the first three quarters, and then in the competitive portion of the fourth quarter, they only scored 12 points basically for the first 11 minutes of the quarter. That it was really ugly, and it just devolved into iso ball, and they weren't able to attack well enough to force help. They, during that time, were 5 out of 17, 0 of 5 on threes, and then also 2 for 6 from the foul line, Tristan Thompson missing a couple there, and they got outscored 19-12 in that time period when the Warriors put the game away.
Yeah, and that included the 12-0 run, which was a great example of what I call feedback loops. So basically, the Warriors were playing good offense, and they were also playing good defense, and so they were just, it was escalating on each other, and that was the part where the fans really lost it, was where, like, the other point was where, so Barnes hit that three, and I think that kicked off the 12-1 run, and the looks that the Warriors were getting were so much better than the ones the Cavs were getting, and unsurprisingly, they were going in. And that's part of what is so devastating about this team, is that they're so good on both ends, and each success makes it harder to bear the overall consequence.
Yeah, there are a couple of huge offensive rebounds for the Warriors, too, where Andre came in and got an offensive rebound over LeBron. Green came in and got an offensive rebound over LeBron, and the Warriors scored 5 points off of that. That was part of their time when they took the lead. So it was really, and then Cleveland, finally, the icing play was Fry and Kyrie in just a pick and roll up top. They switch it, threw it to the roll man. Fry just leaves Steph. You don't leave Steph until someone else gets there. That's for damn sure. And then Steph just hits, you know, did the fake and the flyby and put him up 9 with 5 minutes left. And that was basically about it.
One other play I want to mention, and I think we both fixated on this a little bit, was Curry made a horrendous behind the back pass that basically looked like it was going to be an open run out for the Cavs. And Clay just worked his way back and got a stop by himself.
Yeah, I tweeted that most guys in the league, after a terrible pass like that, you're just going to give up. You can't believe your teammate threw that terrible pass. And he sprinted back, forced Kyrie to miss. Again, another play where you might say, hey, if Kyrie were fresh, he probably finishes that over Klay Thompson, who's not some great rim protector. And then Steph, to his credit, also got back after his horrendous turnover and was able to save it back to Thompson. But yeah, I mean, that was just an example of the type of play, hustle play, that the Warriors were able to make at the end, and the Cavs were unable to make. Couple of little things just overall in the game. The Cavs started with Kyrie on Sean Livingston in that faithful start of the fourth quarter, and although they only gave up one bucket from the post up, Kyrie should be on Andre Iguodala, and they should have a bigger guy on Sean Livingston, because Livingston's going to post up and Iguodala is not going to. And I don't know, I mean, we all expect now it's fait accompli, the Warriors are going to win the title. The Cavs maybe even will roll over on Monday night, but is there anything that the Cavs can do adjustment-wise, anything the Warriors might do adjustment-wise before them?
We've harped on it for this entire thing, but it's justified, but giving more minutes to their guys and being proactive about choosing smart places to rest them. I mean, resting Kyrie when LeBron is on the floor, resting LeBron and probably giving Love a little bit more time with that kind of a second unit, that would do a lot. And yeah, I mean, Cleveland has good defensive players. I think they just need to play them in the right spots.
Yeah, I mean, for Cleveland, I wonder if they will start Love again. I thought that actually Richard Jefferson, while he only had 3 points, played very well. He was extremely aggressive and physical, which was I don't know, I might have even played him more than the 24 minutes that he played, although again, he's 36 years old, you know, you're probably, and the level of intensity that he had, you're probably, you know, he's not going to be able to maintain that over longer minutes, so maybe not. I mean, but just based on how he played, it would have been nice to play him more. Thompson only played 28 minutes, which I think is probably not enough, and Thompson had 6 offensive rebounds, only 1 defensive rebound, which is not really that great. He probably needs to get some more defensive rebounds, although the fact that he's switching out all the time, that's something that's going to make it more difficult for him to get defensive rebounds. J.R. Smith probably doesn't need to play 43 minutes. Maybe give Iman Shumpert a little bit more time, give Delly a little bit more time, try to really wear down Golden State's guards a little bit more. And then, like you said, LeBron and Kyrie, just give them, you know, have them play 41 minutes each, you know, and just see how that goes, you know, because maybe they'll actually have some energy left for the end. But I mean, the other problem just for Cleveland is Golden State is the best clutch team that we've ever seen, you know, like them and maybe 2013 Miami is the only other team in my recollection that comes close to what they've done. And I think that while some of that is a little bit of random noise, they largely have kept that up in the playoffs during clutch time. So even if the game is close, it's hard to expect that Cleveland is going to beat the Warriors down the end of the game. Like, they're going to have to be up significantly towards the end, and expecting them to do that at Oracle in a hopeless situation already in a game five. I guess the only variable, which you probably got to discuss, is if Draymond Green is suspended.
Yeah, and it's possible. I haven't seen as many replays as I'm sure you have, but I mean, from the limited amount I've seen, that could be an interpretation.
So the play in question, after the game is pretty much already decided, Draymond falls down, maybe flopped a little bit, and LeBron definitely makes the effort to just try to step over him, which is, you know, there's certain connotations when you do that. Draymond was getting up at the time. LeBron was kind of straddling him. Draymond took exception to that. He kind of lashed out with his arm, made some contact, but not a ton, near LeBron's groin area. And then LeBron, you know, he lashed out at him again, basically, and started yelling at him. LeBron said in the post-game press conference, basically, that Draymond said stuff that was sort of outside of the line of what it should be. Dave McMenamin later reported that he called him a bitch, and which actually is not nearly as bad as I would have thought it would be, to get that kind of reaction from LeBron. And so I guess what could happen is Green could retroactively be assessed a flagrant one, which would be another flagrant point, and he could be suspended, or they could just suspend him regardless. What were your thoughts on the incident, and do you think either of those things will happen?
LeBron definitely shouldn't have done what he did, especially considering they were behind by, I think, 8 when it happened. And it was something that he did deliberately, you know, and I'm a pretty big LeBron defender over a lot of stuff, but that was something he should not have done. Draymond should not have reacted the way he did. And, you know, if he made contact, there is this really interesting question about the nature of intent versus result. And so in this case, it's a little bit less clear than like when he kicked Steven Adams and the Kiwis in terms of the actual result, and it's different in terms of intent. I mean, he was deliberately kind of taking a swing, whether he was trying to hit him in that region or not. I think that there's a significant chance that he can get a flagrant one, especially there are some of those angles. I've only seen a couple, as I said, that did look really bad, but that would be such a rough thing for the NBA to suspend such a prominent player in that situation. But if it's the right call, I would support it.
Yeah, I don't think he will. I thought that he probably should have gotten teed up during action, because LeBron at least has some plausible deniability that he's just trying to like step over him and get back into the play, even though, you know, you don't like step over a guy and straddle him like that. You know, if you're really actually trying to get back into the play, I think we all know what he was doing. But nonetheless, Draymond then escalating the situation by like going after LeBron and forcing him to turn around and actually like create the confrontation during the play. I felt like that probably warranted a technical, because that really was an escalation. But, you know, it wasn't called at the time. And I think LeBron was certainly frustrated. Obviously, he knew what this loss meant for the team. They had had so much hope after winning by 30 the previous game. So I don't know. My prediction is that he probably won't get suspended. But when you consider that the Steven Adams thing already happened, it got upgraded to a flagrant 2. That was almost like retroactively. Some, including Tim Kawakami, sort of interpret that as, you know, this is your last warning type of thing. So we'll see. We'll see what happens there. And we'll know. We're going to record on Sunday night, so we'll know more about it then. And if he does get suspended, we can analyze how that affects it. But
I know it's going to come down when I'm flying. I know it's going to come down when I'm flying back. That's just the way it's going to go.
Well, you don't have Wi-Fi on the plane anymore?
No, I might. But we'll see. I don't know. I'm flying. We'll see if I want to do that. I mean, I might just try to sleep, considering it's 3:25 in the morning here.
Well, all right. Let's get you out of here then. Coming up, we have the Detroit Pistons offseason preview that I recorded with Dan Feldman earlier. That's going to be awesome. Dan obviously is a big both Cap dork and Pistons fan, so we go really deep on the Pistons. Dan always is quite an affable guest. I recommend you listen to that. After this word from SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the only place to ever go to look for tickets. Actually, my buddy bought tickets to Game 5 using SeatGeek. Got himself, I'm not going to say a great deal because it's the Bay Area and it's probably the closeout game, but a better deal maybe than some other people got, because SeatGeek takes all the hassle out of shopping for tickets. They put all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time, you don't miss a deal, and you could also set alerts for upcoming events. So if the ticket prices fall or get within a certain range, SeatGeek can let you know. You don't have to just keep checking back, so you save a lot of time there. And every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And if you're trying to sell your tickets, you can kind of get an idea of where you should be pricing your tickets if you're just trying to get a fair deal and get your tickets sold. So you can also use SeatGeek's maps to see the view from your seat. And they're always honest and upfront about the price. Unlike StubHub, they show you the full ticket price from start to finish. They're not going to try and trick you into huge fees on the checkout page after you've already gotten all fired up about these tickets that you're about to purchase. Of course, you got to use the CapSpace code if you are a Dunked On listener. You can get a $20 rebate off the first SeatGeek purchase, and more importantly, let them know that you came from us as well. They don't know that unless you enter that code. So they will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. And if you're doing it, tweet at me, let me know how your experience is, and let me know your support in the pod. We appreciate that. All right, we'll be back in a second with Dan Feldman.
Hey.
What's up, man? You want to just start the show right now because we're just such good friends and we seem so cool that way?
Yeah. Let's do it.
So, yeah, I'm really, really sad that we're not doing the Nets or the Bucks, though, the two teams that you have managed to the most critical acclaim during our mock off seasons. But at least you'll have the Bucks during this year's mock off season, though. So we will have the Bucks here, can Redux volume two.
I've got a very exciting plan for them too.
Is it as good as your Brooklyn plan during the mock trade deadline?
More likely to work.
That means it's not as good. Actually. I think it's a lot funnier when the plans don't work at all. You're just bashing your head up against the wall, much like Brooklyn's management for the next 3 years. But we are here, of course, to talk to you about your hometown Detroit Pistons as the founder and still contributor to Piston Powered.
Founder is correct.
Okay. Yeah, so, and obviously you've been to a lot of Pistons games. You moved back to Detroit now from Boston, so you've covered this team a lot. They did not extend Andre Drummond last summer. You want to explain why they didn't do that?
Sure. So when a player becomes a free agent, he counts against the cap at a certain number, dependent on, you know, what type of contract he had, whether he's a bird free agent, early bird, how much money he made before. You know, there's a whole bunch of scenarios, and Andre Drummond's going to count about $8.2 million against the cap as soon as the offseason started. He's going to get a lot more than that. His contract will be much bigger. If he'd signed an extension, his 2016-2017 salary would be what counts against the cap immediately when free agency begins. So by doing it this way, the Pistons can count him against the cap for that $8.2 million, sign him to use that cap, all the cap space they have, and then exceed the cap to sign him to any contract up to what surely will be a max contract.
Yeah, so, and because he's restricted, there's basically, I think, no chance that he leaves, right?
No, I mean, really, the only risk, and I don't think there's much of this, is if the Pistons want to sign him for 5 years and he, you know, forces their hand to push for a smaller deal and would have taken a longer-term extension before. I mean, that's really the only risk, and that's minimal. The cap space is well worth that risk.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess also maybe when they had their negotiations that you're not really allowed to have and agreed that they were going to do this very likely during the rookie extension period, you know, at age 22, there might be a concern that maybe the price of that was a player option. But again, yeah, that extra $14 million in space is probably going to be worth it. So they have that. What are they looking like just from a cap perspective now going into the summer under what I see really is really there's only one really kind of likely scenario to me, at least.
I see two, or I guess three, okay, depending on how we're splitting it. So what I'm sure you see as the likely scenario is they're going to wait on Andre Drummond to sign him until after they've used their cap space. You can waive Joel Anthony. You can renounce your other free agents, including Anthony Tolliver and Steve Blake, and you get to around $16.5 million in cap space. And if there's a good free agent who they can get with that money, I'm sure they'd go that way. But I also think it's possible they leave Tolliver on the books with his $3.9 million cap hold. They can go over the cap because he's an early bird free agent. They could go over the cap to sign him to a deal that starts up to, it's going to be about $6 million. The same with Steve Blake. His cap hold's about $2.8 million. As the market's changing, if you can get, I don't know how much, their main priority is going to be a backup point guard. I don't know how much of a better backup point guard you can get with $16 million as opposed to about $9 or $10 million. And then you'd still need to replace Tolliver. You still need a third point guard. So it's possible they leave either Tolliver or Steve Blake's cap holds on the books, at least to monkey around a little bit first.
Yeah, Steve Blake, his cap hold, I have him at $2.8 million. That seems like way more money than you would want to pay him, even for 1 year, given how bad he was last year, the fact that he's 36 now. But, we've seen old white point guards like Kirk Heinrich kind of, get more money than they should before, so maybe that could happen with him. But I think even Stan realizes at this point that, like, backup point guard was a weakness. I mean, he almost said that, essentially, on J.J. Redick's podcast a couple of days ago.
Well, if you're bringing back Blake, I would think it's as the third point guard, and whether, maybe it's just something with big men, but, with Joel Anthony as the third center, I think Stan Van Gundy somewhat likes the idea of, especially with this fairly young roster, your third string guys, he likes them to be veterans, I think. Not that that's a must, and not that you don't want youth on the roster also, but I do think there's something he likes about that, and I do think with the cap going up, it's possible that Steve Blake's salary next year is more than $2.8 million. I think this makes a lot more sense for Tolliver than Blake.
I agree with you on that, yeah.
But I can't rule out for Blake.
You can't rule it out. I think it should be ruled out. Like, he is below replacement level at this point to me.
Do you think that's definitely true, though, as a third point guard? Because part of the problem is he didn't have the endurance to play as many minutes as he was playing. In the games where he was forced to play more and he was forced to play, game after game, it really took a toll. Maybe as the third point guard and, he's in there in limited situations, he'd look better.
Yeah, but that's why you pay him the minimum. I mean, I think, like, in that role, the opportunity cost, even of just, like, $2 million is too high for me personally. Maybe the B&B losing factory as Danny so awesomely called Blake and Baines together. All right, so I mean, we do realize they need an upgrade at backup point guard. I agree with you that maybe Tolliver could be someone that, especially if it's on a shorter term deal, they could look to retain. But then, other than, let's just put Tolliver sort of in the rotation of guys that they might consider to either bring back or other free agents. They need a backup point guard. What else do they need just in terms of who is not under, when you look at everyone who's under contract for next year, like, what else could they benefit from?
That's a good question. I mean, because backup point guard is so far and away the biggest need. I think they like their starting lineup of Reggie Jackson, Caldwell Pope, Tobias Harris, Marcus Morris, and Andre Drummond. I think they feel like that works pretty well. They could use another scorer off the bench. Jody Meeks hasn't been healthy. If you think he's going to be healthy, he's probably that guy. But you'd also probably look around for somebody who can fill that role. And then I do think that, whether it's bringing back Meeks or somebody else, you do need a bigger forward. Or excuse me, not Meeks, Tolliver. You do need a bigger forward. And like we were talking about, Tolliver has the advantage of he can count less against the cap, and then you can pay him more after using the cap space. So that gives him, I think, an inside track.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind 1 year, $6 million for Tolliver, just using the early bird exception, and then he only counts for 3.9 until then. I think that would be okay.
The problem with the early bird is you have to do at least 2 years. And I'd be fine
with
2 years at that, with the cap going up again, just sort of stopgap guy, and you can stretch that last year if you need to. I really wouldn't have a problem with that, depending who else is out there and what other guys cost. But
yeah, and I guess as we'll get to as well, there's not a huge, unlike for a lot of teams, with some of the extensions that they're going to have to sign, there's not really a huge 2017 opportunity cost with the guys and the young core that they kind of have locked in already. I don't think they're going to be big players in 2017, and Stan has said repeatedly that he doesn't really view them as a free agent destination. He even called them a small market on J.J. Redick's podcast, which that's not really true, but nonetheless, it was... maybe a second year for Tolliver. He is 31, though. I think that probably he was kind of, by the playoffs,
maybe a rotation guy, kind of not. So I would be wary of that second year potentially being a bad contract. So I don't know. We'll see it. But if they do need some kind of a normal sized four man, at least as a backup, I think you're right about that.
And but I just think the priority is so far and away a backup point guard that because like we've been talking about, Tolliver counts 3.9 and he's worth six if that's his market rate, and you can use that extra 2.1 million to get a better point guard. I think that bumps like trying to split up the money between point guard and that bigger forward.
So, all right, let's say they have 16.5 million. You keep Tolliver, that goes down to maybe like 12. Who could they realistically get on the free agent point guard market, one which is relatively ugly this year?
Yeah, I think Pistons fans are going to be disappointed because you hear that big number, 16.5 million, and obviously it's not going to be the same this year. In previous years, you know, you're talking about a star player. This year, you know, I think maybe a dream guy is Jordan Clarkson, who, because of the Arenas rule, it's going to be limited what teams can offer him. And, you know, maybe you go with the mid-level exception the first 2 years and that huge escalator in the third and fourth years. And I think the Lakers would match that. I think the Lakers' dream is somebody offers him that offer sheet so they can work their cap that way. But he would also help.
For anyone who wants more details on that, go back and listen to the Lakers preview that we did that explains kind of how that contract would work and why that would actually be good for the Lakers.
But it would be good for the Pistons. On the off chance the Lakers wouldn't do it like match, you know, I think he'd be good. I really think a more realistic name is Brandon Jennings. I think this is sort of his price range. And Stan Van Gundy has shown he wants the best player he can get. He's not too worried about, you know, some of these long-term cap ramifications with all of this. A lot of it's, hey, we need help here. Let's find a player who can help us and pay what it costs. And I think a lot of the other guys, you know, maybe somebody like Jeremy Lin, I don't think they're going to be able to afford. But Jennings, I think, is going to be in that sweet spot where he'd make sense. It's a little weird he'd be coming back after being traded midseason. But I think Stan Van Gundy grew to like him a little bit, grew to appreciate how much Jennings really loves basketball. And Stan could relate to that. And when he's not your starting point guard, when he's a change of pace guy off the bench, you can live with some of his mistakes a little more.
Yeah, and he even helped them during the time period that he, even when he was just coming back from the Achilles, I thought they played better with just even some relative competence at backup point guard. And that was one of the reasons why that trade, while it was great for the team in the long term, maybe didn't necessarily make them much better for this year when they traded him away to get Tobias Harris. I actually think if they offered, from a monetary standpoint, if they offered everything they had for Jeremy Lin, who's 27, you know, if they offered him a four-year deal starting at $12 million a year, that might be better than, or at least as good as what else he's going to be offered. It's just, especially if they offer the years, I don't know that I would necessarily want to do that. But they also have the fact that Reggie Jackson is the entrenched starter, and while Lin, I think, is better as a backup, he probably wants to go somewhere where he could potentially start, and there are three or four point guard needy teams where I think he would be the presumptive starter, which he'll never be in Detroit.
I would agree with that. With the combination, but I also think he's going to get a lot more money than that. I don't think...
Really?
Yeah, I do. I don't think that's... And then when you add in that he's going to be stuck as the backup, even if it is comparable money to other places, and I don't think that'll be the case, but even if it is, it's hard to see Detroit landing him. And, you know, I look at somebody like Deron Williams or Rajon Rondo, you know, so many teams have either good point guards or young point guards that they want to play. Maybe one of those two guys slips through the cracks and could make sense here.
Yeah, Rondo doesn't really seem like he's worth all the trouble, though. And I also think, like, having a backup point guard who can score would really help this team. I would go more in that direction. But I mean, kind of the problem too, I think, is in some ways, I think they have more money than they know what to do with. You've mentioned that they are willing to overpay when they need someone. And if it's in the short term, I think that's fine. But I don't, like, outside of Lin, I don't see anyone really that I would be happy paying a long-term eight-figure contract to as a backup point guard on this market.
That's an interesting... I would have a lot of the same hesitancies as you. I think they look at it more as, we need a backup point guard, we have this money, you know, let's get, rather than thinking long term, let's get the best backup point guard we can get. And another guy I'll throw out there, sort of a poor man's version of the Jordan Clarkson scenario, is Langston Galloway. You know, and he's younger. He might be somebody you'd be comfortable paying over the years. And the cap's going to go up again, too. So even a contract that's iffy in this summer's cap environment will be maybe reasonable the following year.
What do you think about Matthew Dellavedova? So Galloway is an Arenas restricted free agent as well. We've talked about what that is before on past programs. But Dellavedova now is not Arenas. What about, you know, throwing low eight figures at him? He's only 25, so you're not as worried about how he's going to age maybe as some other people. And he can play also off the ball a little bit at the two because of his ability to spot up. What would you think of him as an option?
This is going to surprise you. I don't think they can afford him.
Dude, I'm going to clean up from your teams in the mock off season. I can't wait as the player agent. If this is what you think the market's going to be, I can't wait for that.
I'm going to get some players, and everybody else is going to be left out in the cold waiting until next year. And my teams are at least going to make the playoffs this year, and everybody else is just waiting for that star free agent class next year. And we're going to lock them up on long-term deals that are going to be reasonable with the cap shooting up.
All right. Yeah. By the way, we're going to record that podcast in like 2.5 weeks, right after the draft's over. So Dan will be back. We have a cast of thousands, all of whom are very, very well qualified. So, yeah, I mean, so they can't afford. I mean, well, all right. You're saying they could afford them if they had the $16.5 million, if they're willing to put that. I think put that in, right? I mean, because here's the thing about like both Lynn and Delly for me is like, we are a year removed. Granted, those guys both had pretty good years, but we're a year removed from those guys being able to, like, having basically no offers at all. Like, I mean, do you think the league perception of them has changed that much in 1 year, even with the rising cap?
Well, Dellavedova, one, I've liked him since he's come into the league, and I'm not surprised it took a while to come for people to come around. He's been better than I thought he'd be, so I've been a little high on him. And two, because he was a restricted free agent last year in a different cap environment, it's not necessarily that people didn't want him. It might also be they didn't want to go to the trouble of making an offer sheet that they thought the Cavs would match, and didn't want to go way over where the Cavs wouldn't match. This year, with everybody having money to spend, maybe somebody will go way over where the Cavs won't match. With Jeremy Lin, I don't know what teams were thinking last summer. I mean,
I agree that he should have gotten way more.
Right. So I can't really explain that.
I think it was just the Lakers stink from like that terrible year that they had. So
there's nothing else. But even that shouldn't have bumped him down that much.
Yeah, but I think just in general, it's tough for them this year because they really need someone who could score. I would actually think Seth Curry would be someone that I would really like for them a lot, too. Someone who can, because they just need someone who can create some offense with that second unit off the dribble. Defensively, Sus not amazing, but I mean, you're not going to get a backup point guard who's good on both ends. Like, otherwise he'd be a starter. Like, that's how that works. So anybody else you like among the unrestricted guys? You know, I think DJ Augustin is someone with whom Stan has familiarity, has played really well for him in 2014-15. What about him?
He'd make a little bit of sense. But as everybody sort of knows out of the book on him, is he needs heavy minutes to feel comfortable and really play at a good level. I don't know if the Pistons are willing to do that, but I think whatever minutes they get, Stan would be more equipped than most to get something out of him. To go to Seth Curry, I like him, and he might be a good value, even if you have to pay enough where the Kings wouldn't match. But the problem, maybe the problem's not the exact
right word. The thing for the Kings, too, is like to match, they would have to use cap space.
Right.
So that's, I think you actually, he might be gettable. I think it depends what happens with Rondo, too. The talk is that they're not necessarily going to break the bank to bring him back either, but I don't think they view Seth Curry as a star. I don't think they can afford, basically, to pay him, you know, $6 million a year or something like that, or seven. We'll see, though. But
they have such a
I think he could be gettable.
They have such a complex point guard situation where the rumblings are they're not as high on Rondo as you might have thought. And then you go, okay, well, you could hand the reins back over to Darren Collison. He looked good as a starter. Now he has this domestic violence thing hanging over his head. And then Seth Curry, like you've talked about, a restricted free agent. It's a complicated situation. So I agree, he might be gettable. The issue from the way the Pistons have pursued these things in the past is if you think Seth Curry is a better value at the number you can get him at than Brandon Jennings at a higher number, but you think Brandon Jennings is the better player, they're going to try and get Brandon Jennings.
You know who also I think would be great for them?
Who's that?
Nando DiColo.
Oh, that's interesting.
you know, he also is arenas limited, but Toronto kind of has some limitations with what they're trying to do. And maybe even you could work a sign and trade for him with Toronto as well. That might be useful. He's 28, but also can play on or off the ball. So you could, you know, give you a little bit more depth as a shooter in case Jody Meeks really never returns to relevance. I mean, last year was kind of a lost year for him, and he's getting into his late 20s now and has only really kind of had, you know, 1.5 good years in the NBA. So I don't know if I would want to be counting on him at this point. What about for like the backup, you know, big situation? I mean, I actually think they could use a better backup center than Baines. I don't think Stan sees it that way, though. But if they don't bring back Tolliver, is there anyone else that you think would be kind of in that $5 million a year price range that they might get as a backup four man?
Do you think Daryl Arthur is going to get more than that? I sort of do.
If I'm writing the checks, he would.
Yeah, I mean, I like him. Do you think Mirza Teletovic is going to get more than that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it all kind of depends on what the years are for those kind of guys as well. I mean, Teletovic, I felt like, should have gotten more last year, but he was coming off of those health issues. I mean, I think he should get more. He's actually kind of an underrated defensive player. He is 30, so, I mean, I don't know, like, maybe 2 years, $10 million. Could, you know, $5 million a year could get someone like that.
I mean,
I don't know. Those type of guys, like at that level, are the ones I'm having the hardest time kind of judging. I'd be very interested to see what those guys end up getting in the mock off season, just as like kind of a proxy.
Yeah, I think they're both going to get more than that. Although Daryl Arthur, I think, has just been chronically, or at least lately, has been undervalued, so maybe you can steal him for that number. And I'd like to, you know, I'd like the Pistons to get him. I think he'd be good. But I do think those guys are going to get more, and you're probably, I think just bringing Tolliver back just makes a lot of sense because he's,
yeah,
you know, he knows the system. He fits fairly well. He's a good locker room, great locker room guy. And where you get that bonus of he counts against the cap less than it'll cost to sign him, I just think he makes a lot of sense. But if you can poach somebody who's a little better, if they're not going for quite as much as I think, or somebody falls through the cracks, you got to be open to it.
Yeah, I also think, too, that they can get some minutes from Stanley Johnson at the four. I mean, you've got those three kind of combo forwards. I mean, Johnson has not played at the four, but he's strong enough to with Tobias Harris and Marcus Morris and him. Like, that's kind of a pretty good rotation, I think, among your forwards if you're thinking that Stanley is going to start playing more this year. Just some quick housekeeping. What do they have in terms of, like, non-guarantees, team options, that kind of stuff?
So Joel Anthony is $2.5 million unguaranteed. I would think they would waive him, but they, you know, if they're looking for a veteran on the bench, you never know, but I would think they'd waive him.
Yeah, I mean, like, the idea that they couldn't re-sign him just for the minimum, I mean, who else is going to pay him more than that? I would be very...
That's a good point.
Very surprised. And his guarantee date is not until January 10th, so they can just sort of keep him around and until they try to sign someone better. So if no one better comes along, maybe they'll just keep him, but I would hope for their sake that someone better comes along.
Spencer Dinwiddie is unguaranteed until November 1st, and I don't know what they think of him. I have a tough time reading that. They, you know, he was hurt a little bit last year. They sent him to the D League for an extended stretch, and I didn't know whether that was because they really like his, you know, developmental potential and they wanted to really give him a chance to play, or is because, man, we just don't see it from this guy. Like, let's just throw him out there for a while and see what happens. It's tough to read. I'm not really sure which way they're leading.
What do you think of him?
You know, he's supposed to be so much a better shooter, and he just can't shoot from outside. And it just makes the rest. He's made great strides. I think he was really bad when he first got on the court as a rookie. Like, on the pick and roll, couldn't turn the corner at all.
And he tore his ACL in, like, January of his last college season, too. So that maybe was to be expected.
And he's made nice strides overall, but without his shooting coming around, he's not an NBA player. So he's got to shoot better. It's that simple. I don't know whether he will.
If he can't shoot, it's basically he's a 6'5 guy who's good at dribbling but doesn't really have much pop athletically and, you know, doesn't have unbelievable vision or anything. I mean, not a guy I'd be counting on at backup point guard, but maybe if the shooting comes around, he still could develop. And he's making so little that there's no reason not to just keep him around next year. Darren Hilliard, I assume that they're going to keep as well. Lorenzo Braun, I would imagine they probably aren't going to keep.
Agree with both those. With Dinwiddie, though, it's not so much the money, it's the roster spot.
Yeah, I guess that's a point, too, although, and we'll see maybe if there's someone else there. So they have the 18th pick, which has a $1.4 million cap hold. I bet they are glad that they did not make that Demo trade now.
You know, honestly, as somebody who likes the Pistons, I'm glad. I don't know if they're glad or not. You know, they might have preferred Demo. You're saying if you're glad they're glad he wasn't healthy enough to make it, or you're saying they're glad that they found out before they agreed?
Well, I mean, I think it was, even if he hadn't failed the physical, that it would have been a bad trade anyway. Because I don't think he's like some big priority for Houston to bring back. And then if you wanted to bring him back, his cap hold would be cutting into their space this year, that they might not be able to get the backup point guard they want, which they really need more.
That's true.
And, you know, they have, I think, as I talked about, I love that they have these three combo forwards that they can kind of play, especially in the East. There aren't some awesome post-up fours that you have to worry about where you need that much more size. Do you see any chance that they might make a trade? I mean, the big thing that's coming up to me here is just this idea that they are kind of locked into this core now, and they're just looking for internal improvement, and that's just kind of see where that takes them the next couple of years.
Yeah, I do think that's the plan. I mean, they could make a smaller deal here or there, you know, something to find that backup four. I could see them, because they did trade away a few second round picks in the future. With the roster pretty complete, maybe you try and trade your second round pick for a future second round pick, something small like that. I'd be surprised if they're making a big blockbuster move this summer.
What do you think of as the ceiling for this core? I mean, Reggie Jackson, he's probably about what he is. I think he's 26 now. Drummond, only 22. There is this free throw issue, which will, even if they get rid of Hacka, is still going to be kind of a problem for him, especially late in games when he's involved in the play. You could foul him as well. KCP, Stanley Johnson, Tobias Harris, those guys are all young. They all have some upside. If all those guys kind of develop, you know, I don't know that any of those guys are going to turn into absolute superstars, but I think they can all turn into very nice NBA players. What do you see as the ceiling if those guys kind of develop as you would hope?
So I was thinking about this, and I was trying to find a team to compare them to, and there wasn't really anyone this year. Some teams are too high, and sometimes some are too low, and so I have to go back to last year, and this is not a stylistic comparison at all. I'm just talking team quality. I see their ceiling something like what the Rockets were last year, or what the Trailblazers were when healthy last year, where you're a pretty good team, and theoretically, if you get the break, you know, you could win a title. Like, this is ceiling I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're, but they're, and most years they're going to be, there's going to be a better team. Last year, obviously, there was a historically great team. But in most years, there'll be a better team, and you're not going to win the title. But if you happen to be good at the right time, you could win a title.
I see them kind of topping out at like 55 wins, maybe.
But isn't a 55 win team like capable of winning a title some years?
Maybe, but because they don't have, I don't think that anybody on this roster has superstar potential, I wouldn't necessarily put them in that category. You know, I'd sort of more put them in the line of like, you know, the Hawks these last couple of years, kind of along those lines. I think they could have a really, really good defense. Like KCP, if Stanley Johnson fulfills his potential, Drummond fulfills his potential, this could be a top five defense every year with that kind of talent on their team. They could be able to switch a lot of stuff. Reggie Jackson is pretty bad defensively, but he could get a little better. And also, like, their starters were pretty good last year. If they just fix the bench, which I think they can do this offseason, you know, that could get them kind of closer to 50 wins with also internal improvement next year. But yeah, I think, and you know, if Stanley learns to shoot the three a little bit better, Tobias Harris gets to be a little bit better shooter and scorer and passer. Same thing with KCP. If he can get up to 37% from three on his volume instead of 34 like he's been as one of the biggest volume three-point shooters in the league the last couple of years, then yeah, I think you could be a team that's winning in the low to mid-50s. And that's not all bad, frankly, like given the fact that they've been mired in this morass for so long up until this year.
I think you're underselling two things. One, and not that we, you know, we're pretty close.
Underselling how big of a Pistons fan you are?
Maybe. One, I do think Andre Drummond has superstar potential. I mean, he's huge, he's athletic, he's a ferocious rebounder. I do think he has superstar potential. Not that he's going to get there, but I do think he has.
Well, so what does that mean? I mean, I think just, I agree with you on defense, he could be, although he is like kind of spacey. I just think that I don't think he has, like, the coordination and the touch offensively to be, you know, as good as, say, like, Dwight Howard was under Stan Van Gundy in those Orlando years offensively, especially because the game has continued to evolve to where post-ups are even less efficient due to, like, the fact that you can zone much better.
Agreed. But he's such a good pick-and-roll finisher, and his offensive rebounding brings a lot of value.
That's a good point.
You know, he's not going to be as skilled as Dwight offensively, but I do think he can be effective enough where you put him in that, can be, not saying will be, but can be in that superstar status. The other is, the Pistons were one of the youngest, or maybe even the youngest playoff team last year. Like, this is a young core, you let them grow together. I do think there's something to be said for chemistry, and I do think it's often overvalued, because what people overlook is, you know, people complain, how could this team break up their core? Like, you gotta give them a chance to develop chemistry. Well, you gotta make sure you have the right core before you decide to stick together with it. You know, if chemistry looks good in hindsight, because teams only pick cores they think will work together over the long run. And this might be a core that can grow together. There's a lot of complementary skills. You let them play together for a couple of years, they could look pretty nice.
Yeah, if I just believed in Reggie Jackson a little bit more to be efficient, like that, I think that would help too. Or if he were a couple of years younger and had like a little bit more ceiling to explore. All right, last question here. 2017, they basically, right as of right now, have $40 million in space. That includes KCP's cap hold, I believe. Let me see. Yeah, that includes KCP's cap hold, but that does not include Drummond's extension. If he signs that max, or not extension, new contract, that's $23 million. Now you're looking at $17 million in space without the KCP extension. That's in a year when the max is going to be $30 million for 7 to 9 years. That's not really that much in 2017. So I think, again, they are kind of locked in. But with KCP, his cap hold is going to be $9.2 million. In 2017-18, what do you think his extension negotiations will look like?
Well, that's tough, because, you know, I do think they should be willing to go over that $9.2 million number, you know, because it's so tough. It's hard enough to get your head around this summer, at least for me, because everything's going to be so radically different. It's so much harder to see what it's going to look like for next summer. I'm sure KCP's starting salary will be well north of $9.2 million. So where's the middle ground where you're saying, okay, because he signed this extension now, we're willing to pay him over his cap hold because we're going to get an overall savings throughout the life of the deal. It's, you know, is he a max player next summer with, you know, with everybody else who's locked in?
Which would be $25 million would be his max.
I mean, with everybody, the cap shooting up and so many players locked into cap, you know, contracts they signed when the cap was lower, it's possible he's a max player, right? You know, if somebody tries to poach him in restricted free agents, because you're going to have to come way over the top to get him. It's tough.
Yeah, I mean, he's good. Like, he can shoot the three, and I think he has the potential to be one of the better, you know, he's not really someone who defends threes, but as a 1-2 defender, you know, or chasing guys around screens, getting over the pick and roll, and Stan was complimentary of his defense recently that he's getting better and making less mistakes. Yeah, I mean, I think he could be really good. I mean, if we think of an average starter this year as $15 million, an average starter next year with the 107 cap is probably $18 million. I think he, especially with his youth, you know, $20 million a year would probably be the lowest that I think he would get on the market next year.
So, you know, maybe the Pistons can, I don't know if this would work, but, you know, for KCP and any player, really only matters their life specifically. Guys are going to be hesitant to turn down, I think, extensions at, you know, these super high numbers that are higher than any of their teammates are making, even if it's below what market rate would be in 2017.
Yeah, and we saw, and the other thing too, with his youth, we could see something along the lines of what Kid Gilchrist or Valanciunas did, where they said, all right, you know, we'll take a little bit less now, we'll get some security, life-changing money, and then give us that fourth-year player option so we can get back onto the market. So maybe something along the lines of like $17 million a year over 4 years might get it done for KCP if he gets that player option on the fourth year. But I if I were him, it'd be hard to advise him to take any less than that, I think, at this point.
Yeah, I think that'd be a great bargain for the Pistons. And if he decides, you know what, this guaranteed money, the safety of that, it's not worth the upside of being able to get more, you know, that'd be a reasonable choice by him. But I think if the Pistons can get him for that, it'd be a great bargain.
Yeah, and then if they do that, then you're eating even more probably – another $8 million or so into that $17 million in space. So you're really just not a player at all in 2017, which I don't think is the end of the world. That's going to be a really bad market. I think getting into the market in 2018, 2019, when the cap isn't going up, much fewer teams will have space during that. So maybe, especially when you're a smaller market, you can kind of look to get in around that time. Again, although even I think most of their contracts would go long enough that they wouldn't even really have much space those years either.
I'm going to go on a slight tangent to make a point, is that I think one of the biggest myths around the NBA right now is that every team is going to go hard after Kevin Durant. A lot of teams aren't. They're going to realize they're not a free agent destination. He's not going to want to go there. They're not going to waste their time. And the Pistons are one of those types of teams. So if they don't have cap space a year from now and they have this core locked in, I don't think they're kicking themselves over it.
Yeah, another thing that they might eventually end up doing too is if Stanley Johnson moves into the starting role, Marcus Morris is on a value contract. You could maybe get something for him to get a little bit more scoring in the backcourt, or maybe even an upgrade at backup center over Baines, who actually amazingly has a player option in 2017-18 for $6.5 million. But all right, we're probably going on too long here. You got anything to plug before we go?
NBC Sports will have lots of finals coverage this week, and then maybe something a little more in-depth on Kevin Durant's free agency.
Yeah, and Dan also is an awesome guy to follow his writing, because he, as part of his job with NBC, he reacts really quickly, and obviously, as you can tell, he knows the cap stuff really well. So in written form, his reacting very quickly to deals during the offseason with kind of the specific cap numbers, he's usually the first guy out with stuff like that. So that's a great reason to read his stuff as well. All right, and Dan Feldman, NBA, is where we follow you on Twitter, right?
You got it.
All right, I am Nate Duncan, NBA on Twitter. Thanks so much for everyone who's giving us an iTunes review or rating. That really helps the show as well.
And we will be back again on Sunday night. Till then.